This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, happy Monday afternoon to you. Today, the Australian avocado industry is eyeing off China as the next major export market. Just before one, we'll head to Mouche and see how the cattle are selling today. We'll take a close look at the yarding and at the prices. And a focus on fires today. An update on a serious fire at Allan Bray Station in the Kimberley. Some success with prescribed burns in the Pilbara. And you'll also hear from a Tasmanian company using cameras, sensors, satellites, drones and AI to help in the early detection of fires.
So we've started in forestry as an industry in terms of, you know, having that early understanding of where fire isn't in the environment. But any large asset owner, and particularly over here in Western Australia where we are today, you know, fire is a risk to everyone in the environment. We try and get to, with this mobile version, a natural high point in the landscape, and then the boom obviously gives us a natural advantage to get up a bit higher.
And we'll kick off the conversation with an update on the fire at Allan Bray just before the news headlines at 12:30 today. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Starting today with a look at the transition to renewables, which can be a divisive issue for farmers and regional communities as governments make big changes to help the economy move from fossil fuels to renewable energy. To look at the role of producers in this transition, a Farming Forever conference organised by Farmers for Climate Change is underway right now in Canberra. Reporter Warwick Long is there.
Today, we broadcast from the National Summit of a farming organisation that is looking for change in the area of climate. They're hearing about agriculture's role in climate change, talking about technology changes on farm, talking about big changes that might be happening across the Australian economy. There are about 300 or so people in the room, half or so are farmers. One of them has been pulled out to come and talk to us before lunch, and that is the Chair for Farmers for Climate Action, Brett Hall. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks very much, Warwick.
Tell us a little bit about your farming. You're a Tasmanian farmer?
Yes, Tasmanian farmer. Beef cattle. It's mainly Angus down in Tassie, about 80%. So, we run the Angus down there and have a breeder operation.
How did you get to be chair of Farmers for Climate Action?
I think I was in the right place at the right time. But this week we're celebrating our 10th anniversary as an organisation. We formed with 30 farmers in the Blue Mountains in a meeting 30 years ago. And now we've built to a stage where we've got 8,400 farmers. Members.
30 farmers meeting. Today they're nearly 150 or so in the room as part of a 300-person conference.
Yes, and it's great to have that diversity right across all areas of agriculture and from all states. And we always thought when we put this together, as it's our first national summit, there's be a challenge to get farmers to go to Canberra because they always sort of say, oh no, I'm not going to Canberra. But we've got, you know, those sort of numbers here, and it's just fantastic to see those people engaged with the whole industry and politicians here in Canberra.
So this is the first national summit?
For us, yes.
Why? Why did you want to hold this and why in Canberra?
Well, we really need to get those voices, those political ears to hear our voices. So that's why we're here in Canberra, and we thought it was the best location to make sure that happened.
Who is Farmers for Climate Action, and what are you trying to achieve?
Well, we've always been a very independent group. We're sort of funded by donors from across Australia, our members, our supporters, and also larger donors. So we really want to have a say in adapting to climate change, making it an issue, making sure that other sectors of the Australian economy are contributing to lowering emissions, as well as making sure that we're doing our part, show a bit of leadership in that area, and that's what we're showing up here today.
And do you get a lot of political interest in what you're doing? Are politicians interested in listening to Farmers for Climate?
Oh, they definitely are. And I think the number of people that are engaged with FCA, they sort of know there's a lot of votes out there in the people that support us and amongst our members. So they're really interested in what we say because they see a lot of votes there and they see us being influential.
Do you feel sometimes Because not every farming group's happy with changes to renewables, right? And I'm sure that's no surprise to you. Do you sometimes feel like you're used by certain elements of politics to put farmer against farmer? And how does that sit with you?
Oh, we don't really see us... We don't tell farmers how to farm. We offer them options as to what they can do on their farms, what things might help them adapt to climate change, that sort of thing. We don't say you have to farm in this particular way. So we provide... experts, we provide the knowledge, and it's up to farmers to choose what is the best fit for them.
And just before I let you go, are you calling for anything specific out of this conference, or is it more about bringing people together and talking about the issue?
Oh, it's about bringing people together, but we sort of want people to recognise that farmers aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Well, Brett, thank you so much for coming out and having a chat to us. It's been good to talk to you today.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Brett Hall there, who is the chair of Farmers for Climate Action and a Tasmanian beef farmer. Tony, Simon, come over here. Tony and Simon are coming over to you. Simon Barton and Tony Inder. Simon Barton is has a wind development on his property out near Wellington. Tony has solar, produces wool on his property too. Welcome both of you to the country. Tony, come around here. Simon, you can stand with the microphone there. This is how we direct traffic. Welcome to the country.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
What brought you two here today?
Just to discuss the positives of, my part, the positives of solar grazing.
Solar grazing is what you're here for. And Simon, what makes you want to be a member of sort of Farmers for Climate Action and be here today?
Oh, I've been passionate about looking after our environment. You know, as a host wind farmer, we're doing a little bit there, but we've got a long way to go in our country to be less reliant on fossil fuels.
And what has the experience been like having a wind farm on your property? How long has it been there for you?
So they came to us probably in about 2007 and said, are you interested? We've always, been working out in the wind all our lives, in the sheep yards and the cattle yards, getting blown over and going, oh, bloody hell, it's windy. But anyway, I'd always thought that, we should be using this resource. They came to us. I said, yes, absolutely. With all the applications that had to go through the EPA and all that, they started building in 2016, finished in 2018, started generating 2019. The process was pretty easy.
How was that seen in your community and by your neighbours?
A little bit of resistance to start with. What I say is people don't like change. When there's change, there's always alarm bells. Now that it's up and going, we haven't heard any negatives. I certainly haven't heard any negatives. And, the community, the local communities, getting benefits out of it.
And, Tony, you're nearby, but you've got solar on your property. And is the solar on your property set up so sheep can graze underneath?
Well, certainly the sheep graze underneath is not ideally set up, but it is more than effective. We've got about 6,000 run at the moment, and essentially it's in two paddocks. So there's a 2,400-acre paddock and a 1,500-acre paddock.
And what's that experience been like, sort of learning the farming system to work with a renewable system?
Interesting, but the results so far, the results are really good. Yeah, the sheep do really well. The grazing season's longer. The feed stays consistently better, ends up in a better wool growth. We've done a few trials.
Because you've got more shade in the paddock, is that right?
Well, more shade and more retention of moisture when we get it. And we go from a 5 mil rain event in summer, which equates to nothing outside the panels, so it actually creates a little bit of runoff, and with the shade effect afterwards, it actually creates feed under the panels.
And just before I let you both go, the experience then of having renewables on the property, it's different for those having transmission lines, but in terms of your experience, has it largely sort of helped in terms of drought-proofing the property in terms of extra income, or am I stretching that?
Oh, certainly renewables are helping with drought income. I mean, it used to be traditionally behind every successful farmer there was a nurse or a teacher, but now we've got renewables as well. It's a win-win.
Yeah, certainly a win-win. We went through the physical drought, and then after the physical drought, there was a financial drought because we weren't selling our livestock. We were restocking. So we've done all that. So the income that the wind farm's generating has been very positive for us and will be in the future.
I wanted to talk to you both about the experience of driving the electric ute that's downstairs, but we're running out of time. So thank you very much for both coming and having a chat.
No problem.
Simon Barton and Tony Inder speaking to Warwick Long at the Farming Forever Conference underway right now in Canberra, and just talking about their experiences with renewable energy on their farms and how it fits in with the traditional business of farming. And they sound impressed, don't they, with the results so far, saying it used to be traditionally behind every successful farmer there was a nurse or a teacher, but now we've got renewables as well. On the text, this just in from Isabel in Darkin. I'm not sure whether you get pleasure out of upsetting real farmers, but listening to these farmers for climate change nut jobs is quite disturbing for 90% of us in WA. Could you get an expert who doesn't believe in the World Economic Forum's climate change scam to put a counter view up for us? Thank you, Isabel. The text is 0448 922 604. Quarter past 12 here on the Country Hour. Well, it's the 1st of September. It is the first day of spring, but the Bureau of Meteorology is saying that winter is still hanging around for a little bit because there's a series of cold fronts that will affect the Southwest Land Division later this week. And you'll get some of the detail on those fronts just after 12:30. First, let's make our way to Cathy Cook's farm, about 3 hours' drive northeast of Perth. So far, their season has gone quite well. So Mark Bennett called in to check out some of the canola crops.
Cathy Cook farms with her family at Culger, 240 kilometres north of Perth.
So Cathy, where are you taking us?
We're just going to head to a block, Mark, that we've recently taken on as a lease, as an opportunity to expand our business. It's about 10 kilometres down the road behind the Culger wheat bin. We always see puddles at Culger, so when the opportunity came up to lease the property, we jumped at it because for some reason we think there's more rain, and that certainly is factual this year. We've actually had about 50 more mils of rain at that farm than we've had at our home farm, so we're enjoying quite a good season there. And I'm going to take you to have a look at some canola, which was a spur of the moment decision to put in. Wasn't in the plan. We had a thunderstorm in late April and we received 34 mils. And after receiving that, we decided to put some canola in there, and very glad we did. It's looking amazing, and it's definitely by far the best canola we have in our rotation this year.
To paint the picture about how much your annual rainfall is, it's pretty small up this way, isn't it? What's your average total?
We work on 10 inches, but can't actually 250 mils. I can't actually remember a year where we got that. We either get 100 or 350. So it's not often that we get an average season. And this year at our northern block, so north of Mollerin, we've received 125 mils, and down here we're around the 170, maybe a bit more, where we're heading now at Culger.
So this was really quite an opportune thing. You went out to check the rain gauge.
What was
the story behind that?
We were seeding canola at our home farm and in dry, and I just knew that there'd been thunderstorms around. Seed a bit of rain on the deep herd weather site, and I thought I'd just make the trip down there and see what was happening. And I nearly fell over when I saw the gauge not only full but into the bottom as well. I immediately tried to get hold of Peter, my husband, to say I think we need to make some changes to the program. Couldn't get hold of him on the mobile, so my next call was to our agronomist to secure some more canola seed. And of course he obliged, met me on the road with the canola I needed, and we shifted our seeding machines to the farm and off we went.
So that was all in a matter of days?
Yeah, less than 24 hours. It was a very spur of the moment decision. It's very hard to make a decision when you can't get hold of your partner, and we make joint decisions, and I just had to run with it. I was not letting that opportunity to go away. Yeah, I'm really happy with how this is potting up, Mark. It's actually coming along really well. So it's probably got another, I'm hoping, at least a month of flowering. So flowering's good. That's how we're making seed. So, yeah, should hopefully be successful.
And when you say this is a short cycle one, what's the growing time for this?
The optimum seeding time of emu is 15th of May, which is very late. Most of the canolas we're growing out here are April, but we actually have a problem out here in the fact that our southern counterparts have issues with frost in September, but actually ours is heat, so we like to get things finished before that heat comes in. So sometimes if you have a late September rain, it can be a lost opportunity because you've made grain fill and you're finished. But I would much rather see the crop finished than get to the heat time when we can get 30 degree days at the end of August, and things do struggle when it starts to get so warm so quickly.
Cathy Cook speaking to Mark Bennett at Coolgia, about 240 kilometres northeast of Perth. And the latest estimate for WA's total grain production this year is around about 22 million tonnes. But of course, that's going to depend on the extent of frost damage, finishing rains and temperatures over the next few months or so. 20 past 12, and we started the hour in Canberra, taking you to the Farming Forever Conference, which is organised by Farmers for Climate Change. And that upset Isabel on the text, who said that listening to these Farmers for Climate Change nut jobs is quite disturbing for 90% of us in WA. In response to that on the text, what's the bet Isabel was doing a march on the weekend? Fruit Loop. Please play more of this environmentally friendly farming. It's what you should be doing all the time. 21 past 12, the text 0448 922 604. Well, the CBH Group has implemented a lockout of all employees covered under the proposed MUA and ETA enterprise agreement. This is at the Kwinana Grain Terminal. The state's main grain handler says it's a significant step and follows 5 weeks of ongoing industrial action, including 24-hour rolling stoppages starting today until Saturday the 6th of September. Chief People Officer Jackie Connolly says the industrial action has caused extended delays in unloading rail wagons, disruptions to shipping activities and bans on essential maintenance and safety works, and it's created an environment of uncertainty in relation to ongoing operations at the terminal. CBH says it's been negotiating in good faith for the past 5 months, participating in 11 formal bargaining meetings with employees and unions to reach an agreement that works for all parties. And the next bargaining meeting is scheduled to take place on this Wednesday, the 3rd of September. 22 past 12.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll get to the news headlines around about 12:30 and then check the weather conditions across the state when we cross to the Bureau of Meteorology. First, though, the Australian avocado industry is eyeing off China as the next major export market. But all the attention isn't just on the export markets. Avocados Australia Chief Executive John Tyas is also hoping more Australians start buying more avos because the industry is going to experience some oversupply problems.
Yeah, we've got a pretty solid crop coming this season. So right now we're moving into Western Australia's production, and they'll dominate the market from, you know, now till about February, and then the North Queensland season will start in sort of late February. So we're seeing fairly steady volumes right through. Similar crop to what we had a couple of years ago, close to 150,000 tonnes nationally.
Yeah, okay. And so let's talk about the consumption. We'll start with Australia. What is the domestic consumption looking like into the new season?
Yeah, consumption in Australia is really high. We've got some of the highest consumption levels across the world. So we're at about 5 kilograms per person. So there's a lot of people that don't eat avocados or don't eat a lot of avocados. And so the people that are eating avocados are eating a hell of a lot. Our main focus really is about trying to increase demand both domestically and in international markets. And, you know, I'm convinced that there's still enormous growth opportunities in our Australian market. When we look at our buyers, we've got light buyers and heavy buyers. And so heavy buyers make out about 20% of all the people that buy avocados are considered heavy buyers, and they're buying more than half of all the avocados. So about 80% of people that buy avocados are only buying less than 50% of all the avocados. So if we can get people that don't buy them very frequently to just increase their consumption a little bit, there's enormous growth potential domestically. But The thing is, you can't make that happen overnight. It takes time. It takes years to keep building. You know, we've doubled domestic consumption in the last 10 years, and I'm confident, you know, we can do that in the next 10 years, but we can't do it in 12 months. And like we've seen over the last couple of years, massive growth in supply into markets that just can't cope with that much fruit that quickly. And so that's why it's been a couple of challenging years, but we've also developed a lot of export markets in that time. We've had sevenfold increase in our exports in the last 3 years off a fairly small base. But again, there's a lot of opportunity for growth in export markets as well.
Let's talk about the export market now. What's that looking like?
Look, it's looking really good. Again, some of these markets are still quite small and they've got a lot of potential growth. So most of our fruit is going into Singapore, Malaysia and Hong Kong. And they're what we call open markets. They don't have phytosanitary quarantine protocols. So anyone can supply there. So they're very competitive. A lot of competition from other countries that are lower cost producers like Peru, Mexico, and we're dominating those markets. Those three markets, we've got 75 to 85% market share. So we've really captured that market. But consumption levels there are one or less kilos per person per year. So again, there's a lot of growth in those markets. But they're still relatively small markets, and we need to keep looking at other markets. We're seeing the Middle East is growing really well. Some parts of the country have got access to other markets like Japan and Thailand, and the whole of the country's recently got access to India, but that's a market that's going to take time to grow. There's a lot of competition from cheap African suppliers. But the one we're really wanting is China. China is a fairly established market. Their consumption is about 70,000 tonnes that they import at the moment, and it's only set to increase. They're struggling to find a supplier of good quality product, and they're desperate to get their hands on Australian fruit. What we don't have is the phytosanitary protocols that need to be negotiated between the Australian and Chinese government, and we're keen to see that happen as soon as possible.
So what percentage of Australian avocados are exported at the moment, and what sort of percentage are you hoping for that to get to?
Yeah, look, it's about 15%. We really need to get that up to 30 to 35%, particularly for this region. This region has got the greatest growth that's coming in the next few years. And so growers need to be thinking about, how are they going to get about 30% of their crop into these export markets. And it doesn't mean every individual grower suddenly needs to become an exporter, but they need to be growing good quality, robust fruit that can handle the export supply chains, and they need to be building connections with the established businesses that are doing all of the business in those markets, developing those relationships, commercial relationships to get 30% of their crop offshore. So a lot of fruit out of this region is going into Hong Kong in particular, and the good thing about that is that a lot of the people in mainland China experience the quality of Australian fruit in Hong Kong. So they know that once we can get access to China, they know that they'll have access to excellent quality fruit. And they're chomping at the bit to get their hands on our fruit. We've had several importers that have come out here a number of times. We had a delegation that came to Avo Connections in Brisbane a few months ago. We don't know when it's going to happen, but when it happens, it'll be a really significant outcome for the industry.
So there's very clear demand from China's side for Australian avocados.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, last year we signed a pre-purchase agreement with the Shanghai wholesale markets to import $300 million worth of Australian avocados. That was their commitment, and they made that announcement, and they're keen to actually increase that. So there's no doubt that there's an enormous appetite and enormous potential in China. We just need to get that market access.
Chief Executive of Avocados Australia, John Tyas, speaking to Sophie Johnson, 28 past 12. Well, it was a close call at Allan Bray Station in the Kimberley over the weekend. A bushfire flared up and about 2,500 hectares of land was burnt on the property, which is about 230 kilometres west of Kununurra. DFS Kimberley Superintendent Glenn Hall says the fire started Saturday morning, forcing the evacuation of about 40 campers and 9 staff, but teamwork prevented the situation ending in disaster.
So with Allan Bray, we responded to that fire, and thankfully we did. And yesterday we were very active working with the pastoralists and the Indigenous ranger groups. at Ellen Bray, and thankfully we did have some saves. We lost some minor shed and some camping infrastructure. There was a shade cover or something that was lost. But difficult conditions yesterday, which did require the evacuation of campers, and they were instructed to continue travelling further along the Gib. And my understanding and my information at this stage is the station will keep that area closed until it stabilises. The fire is pushing west and also to the northwest. We've reduced it from the emergency warning, and we're still monitoring, and we've still got staff on site there today.
So with some shed infrastructure burned in that fire, if there had not been fire crews attend, and incredible given the remoteness of the location as well, if you hadn't been able to be there, what could have happened?
Well, it was great news that we did have some staves. From my understanding, the homestead and the staff admin living quarters were under threat, as well as the workshops. There was some fuel area at the some fuel stored at the airfield. Again, some great work done by not only the crews that we dispatched, but also the pastoralists and the Indigenous ranger groups. And if we didn't have everyone working together, we obviously could have seen far worse circumstances evolve.
Glenn Hall, what other fires of concern at the moment are DFES keeping their eyes on?
Oh, we've got multiple incidents right across the region. Just to give you some figures, approximately 25,000 hectares was burned at Ellen Bray. Just across the Dampier Peninsula, we've got, in the last week, we've had over 100,000 hectares burnt. We've had a fire out at Meter Station, which burnt another 30,000 hectares. We've had a fire on Curtin Air Base, which is another 250-odd hectares. And then, obviously, we've had the incident at El Cuestro Station that affected that infrastructure. Thankfully, we didn't have any losses, again, by some action of Indigenous ranger groups, our crews, which we also had assistance from Perth. So some good news there also. But certainly an active part of the season.
Yeah, a bit going on. Kimberley DFES Superintendent Glenn Hall speaking to Vanessa Mills about the great combined efforts to control that fire on Ellen Bray Station, about 230 kilometres west of Kununurra. There are about 30 fires currently burning in the Kimberley, and so the advice from DFES is if you're travelling in the area, just check the Emergency WA website for the latest updates so you can figure out whether it's safe or not to go where you want to go. On the Ellen Bray Station Facebook page, there is a post that says the property is currently closed to the public. It says we'll post further updates once we can assess things more thoroughly, and hopefully we can welcome guests again in the coming days. It's been a pretty full-on day, but people, property and infrastructure around the homestead are all okay. We are, however, a little charred on the outside. A massive thank you to DFES for coming to our rescue. And just after the four-day weather forecast today, you're going to hear from a Tasmanian company that's developed a mobile unit that uses all sorts of high tech to protect valuable assets like plantations, mine sites and national parks. We'll get to that shortly. 27 to 1, Tony Carr is here with an update from the newsroom.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Three people are facing charges over incidents during anti-immigration rally in Perth yesterday. An 18-year-old woman and a 19-year-old man are accused of carrying or possessing an edged weapon, while a 39-year-old man was charged with obstructing a public officer. Police issued 13 move-on notices during the event. The WA Liberals leader says there should be an inquiry into the state's under-pressure health system. Ambulance ramping records in the state reached a new high this year, and more than 100 elective surgeries were cancelled last month to make room for emergency patients. Basil Zemplis says the state's healthcare system needs urgent attention. And hundreds are feared dead following a strong earthquake in eastern Afghanistan. The magnitude 6 quake struck in a mountainous area close to the border with Pakistan and was at a very shallow depth. It hit the region at around midnight local time, which means many residents would have been asleep in their homes. Dozens of houses are reportedly under rubble, with the Taliban government urging humanitarian organisations to help with the rescue efforts. Belinda, more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for the update, Tony. 26 to 1.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Great to have you along this afternoon on the ABC, right across WA, streaming live on the web and, of course, on the ABC Listen app. Just before 1 o'clock today, before the 1 o'clock news, heading off to Mushe for the results of the cattle market today. Terry Birkin will go through all the details for you. But just as a little preview, just under 900 head of cattle sold at Mushe this morning, and a lot of those cattle coming from stations. Terry with all the details just before the news at 1. Let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Angeline Prasad is with you this afternoon. Ange, let's take a look around the Southwest Land Division.
Good afternoon, Belle. Yes, the sunny weather continues across the Southwest Land Division with fairly mild temperatures during the day. We're seeing a weak cold front brush past the southwest coast, so just one or two light showers south of about Mandurah to Bremer Bay today, and sort of similar pattern tomorrow with showers continuing south of Mandurah to about Ravensthorpe to about Israelite Bay, so staying very coastal. Now, tonight, it's going to be mostly clear again under a weakening ridge of high pressure through inland parts of the Southwest Land Division, so it's going to be another cold night with temperatures dipping below 3 degrees across large parts of the Southwest, the Central Wheat Belt and the Great Southern, and so it's likely we'll see frost tomorrow morning again. The next weak cold front is going to come through on Wednesday, and again, it's going to produce very light showers just along the southwest coast. In the meantime, we'll see a cloud band starting to develop across the Gascoyne tomorrow. This cloud band is going to thicken. It is going to become associated with a west coast trough that is going to develop by the end of today. So over the next couple of days on Tuesday and Wednesday, the west coast trough will move inland, and we'll see this cloud band thickening. So much of the rain misses the Southwest Land Division. However, the area east of Southern Cross and also much of the Esperance region, the southeast coastal district, will see some rain from this cloud band on Wednesday and Thursday. So Wednesday, these areas will see maybe 3 to 5 millimeters. And then on Thursday, the area east of Esperance especially will see maybe 2 to 5 millimeters. The cloud band does contract east out of the state on Friday. So there might be a bit of rain over the far eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division with this cloud band. Now, the next significant cold front that's going to bring widespread rainfall to much of the Southwest Land Division is going to be on Friday. So heavier falls are likely, as usual, over the western districts, but we could see 5 to 10 millimetres across much of the inland parts of the Southwest Land Division on Friday, and another 5 to 10 millimetres if the guidance is correct at this stage. So, yeah, 5 to 10 millimetres on Friday and 5 to 10 millimetres on Saturday as well if the guidance maintains a significant cold front, as it's suggesting at the moment.
And then what can you see for northern and eastern parts of the state, Ange?
As mentioned, there is a cloud band that is developing, so we could see one or two light showers over the western Gascoyne from tomorrow. So the cloud band does thicken tomorrow, but it deepens a bit more on Wednesday and Thursday. So on Wednesday, the showers associated with this cloud band will extend into the goldfields and Eucline, also the western parts of South Interior. It's going to be fairly patchy, so widespread 1 to 3 millimetres, but there could be isolated falls up to 5 millimetres. The cloud band is thickest on Thursday, and we could potentially see 5 to 10 millimetres, but isolated falls maybe 10 to 20 millimetres through eastern parts of the goldfields, the Eucline, also southern parts of the interior as this cloud band moves up to the east. The rain is expected to ease on Friday. The cold front that I mentioned before will bring rainfall to the western parts of the Gascoyne, western and northern parts of the Gascoyne, but also to the Goldfields and Eucla on Friday and into the weekend. And some of these showers may extend all the way out to Exmouth. So just a few light showers are possible over the northwest capes on Friday into Saturday. The rest of the north, the north interior and the Kimberley, it's going to be settled across these areas for much of this week. It's going to be a broad easterly flow. So mild to warm daytime temperatures, but otherwise expecting settled weather across the north.
Ange, thank you for going through those details. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
It is 21 to 1. Richard Hudson in the studio now to take a look back over the weekend at the rainfall.
Yeah, so from 9 a.m. Friday until 9 o'clock this morning, nowhere in WA actually recorded more than 2 mils of rain. So nothing to go through there, but it sounds like there's a bit more on the way. Quick footy update, though, in the Avalon League. It was the preliminary final yesterday at Beverley Oval. Quereting beat Northern Railways by 3 goals. So they're into the grand final against Cunderdin, who last week beat Railways by just 1 point in the qualifying final. So interesting to see who goes on to win. But just to continue our discussion on fires, cameras, sensors, satellites, drones and artificial intelligence are now all being used to prevent, detect and fight fires. But a Tasmanian company called Fire Foresight is combining all of that technology into one mobile unit. CEO Rob Vernon says they can be used to protect any valuable asset like plantations, mine sites, national parks and communities.
So think of it like a mobile trailer with a massive solar panel on it and a big boom mast that we can get up to about 10 metres. And on top of that boom is a camera that can look around in 360 degrees. And we actually take the vision from that camera and use artificial intelligence to be on the early lookout for bushfire.
Who would be interested in buying one of these?
So we've started in forestry as an industry in terms of, you know, having that early understanding of where fire isn't in the environment. But any large asset owner, and particularly over here in Western Australia where we are today, you know, fire is a risk to everyone in the environment. We try and get to, with this mobile version, a natural high point in the landscape, and then the boom obviously gives us a natural advantage to get up a bit higher. So large asset owners, but ultimately emergency services and fire agencies are our end users in terms of where this information heads. But corporate interests and then serving community goodwill.
So just to be clear on how it's established, does this actually sit permanently somewhere or do you transport it from one spot to the next?
Designed for all of the above. So, if we, rather than being on a fixed site, we can move these things out there. We've designed them to sit out there for years, but we can bed them down like that, or we can use them for a couple of months. You know, fire is seasonal, and we can move it based on where and how the season unfolds. But also in the event of, you know, we've got a reasonable understanding of what the weather's going to do this week, we've got an even better understanding of what the hot day conditions might be tomorrow. So we've designed that in mind to be playing an active role in both detection, but also, you know, the unit can operate as an emergency hub from a communications point of view. You know, we've got satellite comms on there, we've got multi-LTE pathways, and we're pushing out Wi-Fi so we can actually use these things in the event of emergency to provide better connectivity.
Right. Now it's my role to pull this apart. Find all the faults in it.
Sure.
If you've got a camera on top, aren't you limited by the line of sight?
Line of sight is a thing, and that's why we try and get these things to a natural vantage point in the landscape. Obviously, being able to go up as high as we can affords us that opportunity. Where we got started this, you know, typically on mountains, WA is a pretty flat place. So, yeah, we're pushing that. We're updating our AI models to be more effective in this type of landscape. Triangulation works really well. If we have the opportunity to deploy multiple of these, then triangulation becomes a far better proposition for us. But we're also stitching in other technologies as well. You know, we're using sensors that are in the environment that can, in essence, smell for smoke. We're using satellites and an increasing number of those to provide us the angle from up on above. So that, again, helps us verify and pinpoint fire in the location. We're working on things like deploying drones to actually go and, if we've got a bearing, send the drone out and it can help pinpoint that location as well.
Why is the AI needed? I'm a bit confused.
The AI actually has been proven to be better than the humans who are there to do the job. So where we got started with this, we'd been on tops of fire lookout towers. You know, those are only typically manned for particular parts of the year or particular times of the day. We're out there all the time and we're looking for those telltale signs of, you know, smoke columns rising. Close at home, daytime records like 78 kilometres away we saw a fire. Nighttime was like 130. Now, those are things that we are seeing more and more frequently. This technology's got a real role to play in that, particularly in remote and regional locations.
So is the AI for recognition of some of these things?
Yeah, so it's, you know, drawing attention to something. Fire in Australia, fire is very common in the environment. From an agricultural point of view, you know, there's always something out there. It doesn't mean we need to be on the phone to 000 every time. So the AI is also stitching together all of these other sources of information We're basically trying to validate that fire shouldn't be there. So, you know, if there's planned and registered burn permits that we can pull in, basically we're saying, well, we know that that fire should be there. You know, if we know that the fire has been located on an agricultural property, well, you know, we know that the farmer might be doing some burning off or something like that. So it's about being more clever. It's being able to do this at scale. And so that, you know, we've just got more informed information in front of it. Ultimately, we make a decision point around escalating through to fire agencies, and then they've got all of that work is done in terms of validating. We're basically dropping a pin on the map and saying, you've got a fire, it is here, here's the best pathway for you to get there.
Is it all about trying to make sure you're staying on top of fires as far as safety goes? Is there also a monetary factor here? Let's say I'm a mining company or I've got a company and we're planting some expensive trees that have been growing for 15, 20 years or whatever.
Yep.
If you're able to protect those assets, is there an advantage as far as, I don't know, insurance goes?
Yeah, absolutely. So insurability of asset is a main driver for things like forestry. So, you know, that's an asset, it has a value, but that value will be recognised in about 20 years. So that's one end of the spectrum. Another end of the spectrum is, you know, mining and, you know, the risk to occupational health and safety and people who are living on remote mine sites, you know, the risk of operational shutdown, you know, that, you know, millions of dollars an hour of lost revenue. So it's a spectrum in terms of, you know, what's the driver in terms of risk for, you know, large asset owners like that. The wonderful thing about it, through that angle, though, is all of these companies realise that they have a role to play in terms of, you know, their involvement and their protection of their local communities, right? It's where their people come from. It's why they're there. So, you know, they see themselves as having a role to play in terms of being a part of the jigsaw puzzle that is fire. So it's really pleasing to see.
Do insurance companies recognise this sort of thing, though?
It's interesting. We've had some chats with insurance companies and globally, like we're doing this globally, and yeah, you know, it's early days, but I think the big mover for them is if we can collectively all have an understanding here that we detect a fire sooner and the arrangements that are in place mean that we get to the fire and we put the fire out sooner, absolutely. Insurance are all over that. So, you know, we're closing the gaps in terms of having that understanding. It's an evolving space, right? They're definitely interested. It's the reason why we are pushing forward with what we're doing in terms of building a heavy lift drone capability. So, you know, carrying hundreds of litres of water over to a fire and being there minutes after we actually detect it as well. So we're playing a role in post detection. We're building some capability in terms of suppression. You know, we want to play a meaningful role in terms of detect a fire. Let's go put it out.
Rob Vernon is the CEO of Fire Foresight. He was speaking to Richard Hudson about how they're combining AI, sensors and satellite technology to help detect and manage fires. And if you want to know what it costs, roughly $120,000 a year. So that might not be within everyone's budget. 13 to 1. Well, most of the fire coverage we do here on the Country Hour is about authorities and volunteers trying to put those fires out. Managing fire across hundreds of kilometres is no easy feat, particularly when you're dealing with the incredibly flammable Pilbara Spinifex. But in the Millstream Chichester National Park, 100 kilometres south of Karratha, authorities have reached the point where they no longer send crews to battle some blazes. And that's thanks to a prescribed burning method that's been underway for the past decade. Fine-grain mosaic burning uses modern technology along with traditional techniques used by Indigenous people for thousands of years. DBCA Pilbara's Pedro Palero says the technique has proven to be highly successful.
We've observed, despite several ignitions over the years or several bushfires over the years, they've always remained very small and allowing us to manage the fires or monitor the fires remotely and not actually having to send crews. And, yeah, with very positive impacts to the landscape as well, and while reducing impacts to the community, reducing impacts to the industry, you know, protecting cultural values and the environment, fauna and flora.
How do you manage a fire remotely without having to send crews? How does that work?
Because DBCA, in collaboration with traditional owners and other partners, because we've been implementing these burns across the landscape, we have access to the location of where these burns have occurred. So we have high-resolution fire scar data, and this allows us to produce a map that shows where these burns have occurred, and we know exactly where fires have potential should they occur, where fires have potential to become large, or if they are in a location that we know is surrounded by burns, then we can safely say that we can monitor them remotely.
Is that risky? Because what if that doesn't prove to be the case? What if it does get into a bigger area that hasn't been burned?
So with BBCA, we base our decision-making process in sound, in the most up-to-date research and also operational experience. And we know that fires in Spinifex country, depending on the rainfall, usually sustain themselves at ages older than 6 years old. So anything that's younger than 6 years old typically does not burn or doesn't go too far. So we use this information to assist with our decision-making process.
What kind of benefits have you seen from doing this in the past 10 years?
In the past 10 years, we've noted a dramatic decrease in the size of the bushfires. So Millstream was traditionally burned by bushfires, large-scale bushfires, in just one single event. So in just 1 year, the park used to burn almost its entirety would burn. So with the systematic application of fire on an annual basis since 2015, we're now in 2025, we still haven't had one of those large-scale fires. So we're definitely seeing some positive results.
There is often a lot of pushback from certain members of the community when you talk about prescribed burning, and there's been some recent data which has, I guess, cast some doubt over the positives of it when you look at species impact on native species and things like that in Australia. How can you be sure that what you're doing isn't negatively impacting the environment, the native flora and fauna?
This work is done with DBCA in collaboration with traditional owners and other stakeholders, and is backed up by sound research and operational knowledge. And we are monitoring, we have research happening at the moment at Millstream and other areas to ensure that we are keeping in on top of the potential impacts of these burns to try and learn and adapt and adjust moving forward as required.
Would you say that what you're doing now is best practice fire management?
What we're doing now aligns with historic Aboriginal traditional practices. So we have evidence from research from the Western Desert, evidence from aerial imagery from the Western Desert taken in 1953 that shows an impressive mosaic created by Aboriginal people. And the work we're doing at the moment tries to mimic that work that has occurred in the past and is proving great results. For the first time in this sort of short 37-year period, we are observing an increase in the older vegetation classes. So we've noted a 4% increase in Spinifex grasslands over than 18 years old, which is very important as a habitat for fauna. And we haven't really been able to observe that for the period before. So I would say that we are seeing some really positive impacts and positive results from our current application of fire to Millstream. And surely there's probably still some fine-tuning required, but at the moment is definitely working. The Pilbara landscape is one of the most flammable in the world, with fires burning nearly all year round. And the weather is also very extreme, with very hot and dry conditions for nearly 6 months of the year. So having this fine-grained mosaic of vegetation ages across the landscape is proving to work very effectively to protect the community and everyone else.
Pedro Palero, who represents the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions for the Pilbara, he was speaking to Michelle Stanley about a prescribed burning technique they've been using in the Millstream Chichester National Park, which helps them control spontaneous bushfires without needing to send crews to monitor the blaze. And there are lots of prescribed burning and burn-offs going on at the moment, particularly in the Southwest Land Division. 6 minutes to 1 o'clock. The North Australia Fire Information Site, known as NAFI, has managed to lock in another year of funding, but it hasn't been easy. The NAFI website was developed by Charles Darwin University about 20 years ago and is a real-time fire tracking tool, providing satellite maps of active fires. The website is used daily by ranger groups, cattle producers, carbon farmers, pretty much all landholders in the north. NAFI's Peter Jacklin is relieved the money has finally come through, but ideally he'd like a longer-term funding arrangement to give everyone more certainty.
Yeah, it's good news. We've been talking with the federal government in recent days, and they're just finalising our funding for this financial year. It's a bit late, but the good news is that we're getting sufficient additional funding for what we need, which is basically we're getting extra staff so that we can back up staff who leave or who depart or whatever. And we also have these extra resources for the workload we've been under. For your listeners' information, the usage of the NAFI service has roughly tripled over the last 3 or 4 years. So, we've been under the pump a little bit. Yeah. But that's good. So we're getting that funding. And I think also they're working on ongoing funding. So it's not just 1 year, which we often do.
And that's your holy grail, isn't it, for NAFI?
It is. And the holy grail really, I think, is to be incorporated into a federal funding system. And that's always been our problem. We're sort of like a little bit like a bomb site for fire in rural and remote Australia, particularly northern Australia. And that just has been difficult to slot that into a federal funding system. And I think that's something that is now being worked on. And again, details still to come, but it's looking positive.
So what's the rough dollar figure per year to keep this website?
So we've asked for, before we've put out the numbers, around 3.5 million for 3 years, so you're a bit over 800,000 a year, and that's ballpark what we're looking at getting.
Peter Jacklin, he's from Charles Darwin University, speaking to Matt Brann about the North Australia Fire Information Site, or NAFI, as it's known, securing funding for another year. And they normally have about 6 staff, but they can now take on another 2 employees as a result of that funding. 3 minutes to 1.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. As anti-immigration rallies lead to violence and arrests across the country, how do the major parties respond? The search for fugitive Desi Freeman now extends into a second week. His wife pleads that he gives himself up. And as summer holidays approach and you book your holiday letting, consider a new report which estimates they're reaping in hundreds of millions of dollars a year in benefits through negative gearing. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Terry Birkin has been at the Mouchet sale yards this morning for the cattle sale. Hello, Terry. How did it go?
Hi, Belinda. It was a similar size sale to last week with 867 head. Local cattle were in limited numbers, however, quality was still good and recorded gains in local calves while the cow market remained firm. Pastoral cattle dominated the sale and there was quite a variation in size and ages, ranging from light calves up to grown steers and heifers. Pastoral cows were prominent and the medium weights were yarded in large lines over 3 to 4 pens. Local weaner steers were selling from 278 cents to 408 cents to remain equal, while weaner heifers gained 25 to 30 cents, making 282 to 396 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers under 330 kg sold from 274 to 452 cents, and heavier weights also sold to a top of 452 cents, lifting 25 to 30 cents. Yearling heifers under 330 kg were selling from 300 to 388 cents, and with more weight and frame, sold up to 408 cents a kilo, also dearer by 25 to 30 cents. Light pastoral steer calves started from 202 to 298 cents, and older calves with more weight reached a top of 366 cents a kilo. Small frame pastoral heifer calves ranged from 100 cents to 260 cents, and bigger framed heifers sold to a top of 370 cents a kilo. Grown steers ranged from 340 to 380 cents, while grown heifers returned 242 to 376 cents a kilo. Light prone pastoral store cows sold from $0.80 to $1.50, while bigger frame store cows returned $1.60 to $2.66 a kilo. Medium weight cows returned $2.30 to $3.40, and heavy cows sold to a top of $3.60 a kilo. Plain bulls back to paddocks sold from $1.60 to $2.70, while bulls suited for shipping range from $1.60 to $3.52, depending on quality. Local heavy bulls lifted 20 cents, selling from $2.80 to $3.44, while pastoral heavy bulls returned $2.82 to $3.14 a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much for that, Terry. And just repeating the news out of the Kwinana Grain Terminal, the CBH Group has implemented a lockout of all employees covered under the proposed MUA and ETA enterprise agreement. And this follows the start of 24-hour rolling stoppages starting today until, well, going for the whole week, until Saturday, the 6th of September. Good to talk to you today. It's news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.